There's so much to cover when we think of ancient Egypt, and we have had really the who's who, the top experts and authors talking about Egypt over the years. But as we continue into Egypt month, we are going to touch upon not only the media with our media critic, Adam Young, today. We'll also have Chuck, who doesn't give his last name, Chuck, who has a YouTube page called CF Apps 7865, and really drilled down into some of his best videos on YouTube. And he's got some real fantastic unknown sites that he'll talk about today if you were to go to Egypt. And many of us can't go to Egypt. So these references are great ways to see what a lot of the experts that we have on the show talk about. So that's going to be fun. Our guest today is Dr. Edward Bynum. He has written a real fascinating book called Dark Light Consciousness. And he looks into the ancient systems of spiritual awakening. And this is something that has always been of interest to me. And this book has been very well received. It came out a couple of years ago, but most people don't know about it because it has a small publisher. But his presentation today really outlines how the sacred sciences of ancient Egypt really worked on a personal basis, and how through meditative practices, people were able to connect on a much deeper level. And at that time, it was mostly the priests or the initiates that were interested in learning more about various levels of consciousness. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, February 17th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, you. Welcome. How you doing this week? How's things coming along? Hey, thanks for dropping by. Nice to have you with us. Here in the Bay Area, it's San Francisco Beer Week, and I think I've talked a little bit about my passion for good beer. My cohort, her name is Deborah, we love barrel-aged beer, and some people know how to make really good barrel-aged beer. And what's that? What is barrel-aged beer? Well, a good brewer will take an empty whiskey, bourbon, port, in some cases, red wine barrel, and they'll stick a beer in it. Now, the good beer, the beers I like are stouts or porters, and they'll put these dark beers in a whiskey or a bourbon container and let it sit for 6 months, a year, sometimes a couple of years. And when those beers come out, they are not only are they stronger, but they're really, really flavorful. There's something about spirits, and specifically rye whiskey, bourbon, and port, that really enhances the flavor of a stout. And there's a couple of breweries out here in the Bay Area that are just really experts at this. And during Beer Week, there's barrel-aged festivals that some bars put on, and a few locations will unveil a special barrel-aged beer. But I'll tell you, if you don't know what you're doing, you can destroy the beer. And a lot of these guys that are playing with it will introduce a beer that will taste what I call boozy. And when I say boozy, it is that the booze is overwhelming. The spirit has overwhelmed the beer. And this is a fine art. It's a real fine art. And, you know, craft beer is a challenge for a lot of microbreweries, simply because they are brewing for smaller batches and they're experimenting. And some of these guys out here are really good at it. They've got it down. They know how to measure the wheat, the barley, the water, and how to ferment the beer so that everything comes together. And then when they pour it off, what they bottle is a finished product of exquisite taste. But a lot of these guys, you know, they experiment on the public. And I guess I'm a snob. I'm sorry. I mean, if someone's experimenting with me, you know, put it on the label. Hey, this is an experiment. I mean, there's so many of these craft breweries out here that are just producing crap. I'm sorry to say. And it's funny because Deborah always reminds me, and I know she's listening. She's like, no, these people have families to support. Don't be trashing them. But, you know, it's funny. Don't produce the beer. Let it sit or, you know, dump it. Don't, you know, experiment on me when you're making beer. So anyhow, SF Beer Week. I was reading the other day, close to 1,000 events over the 7 days. I think it started the 9th last Friday, and it ends on the 18th, Sunday the 18th, in every place you go. I'm in the East Bay area. Tons of events in San Francisco, tons of events in San Jose, events up in Santa Rosa. For those of you who don't live in the United States, you know, in Europe, beer, especially in Northern Europe, beer is a big deal. And when I was traveling in Germany, some of the small cities had their own breweries, and they know how to make beer over there. Jesus, I mean, they make amazing beer. And we're still figuring it out over here. A lot of breweries do a great job. But this whole craft beer movement has gotten so big that now established breweries are going out of business because they can't keep enough patrons to drink their beer. So anyhow, Craft Beer Week is here. Yeah, I mentioned that I'm in the development stage of a new podcast. I'm not going to tell you what it is. And I lost my intern last year, and for personal reasons, she couldn't continue. But it's tough because I'm really shorthanded in producing the show. I mean, Earth Ancients is a lot of work, and I'm hoping to get somebody here soon. But if you're in the Bay Area and you're interested in helping out and joining Earth Ancients, send me an email to cliff@earthancients.com. You got to be in the area because we got to meet once a week or more to go over each week's program. It takes, you know, a long time to book the speakers, to put the show together. And we're evolving, you know, we're evolving the program so that it's more sophisticated, so it has more outreach, it has more interest for a lot of people. But if you'd like to join us, you'd like to join me and the network, the Earth Ancients Network, send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com if you're in the Bay Area. Or if you're flying in and out, if you're doing business here and you'd like to, you have some free time, I need somebody who can give me about 10 or 15 hours a week, but maybe more once this other project gets going. So consider it. Yeah, it's really critical that I get that. Hey, each week I get a bunch of emails from you out there, and I'm going to read one today from Ryan. Ryan's in Ohio. He says, hey, Cliff, I started listening to your podcast a few months ago, and I have to say it has totally changed the way I think about our history. I've always been fascinated with ancient history, but always assumed the mainstream academia was correct. Not now, not after listening to Earth Ancients. I am now completely obsessed with learning more about our real history. I've been looking around, but haven't found anything like your podcast. So I am really dreading the day where I'm completely caught up and have to wait a week for new podcasts. I have an hour commute each way to work, so have been knocking them out quickly. I have to admit, the episode related to Mars has really been blowing my mind lately. I saw stuff on Ancient Aliens, but somehow I have a difficult time taking them seriously. While I think our existence or evolution may have been directly affected by ETs, I don't think that everything extraordinary from our ancient past was created by aliens. You have sparked my fascination with the Maya. If I were in a better place financially, I would be the first one to sign up for your upcoming tour to Guatemala. Gotta pay off my student loans first. Visiting as many of these ancient sites is definitely something I've added to my bucket list. I live in Ohio, so I plan on visiting the Snake Mound once the weather breaks. I've always known it existed, but I thought it was built in the last 1,000 years. Anyways, just wanted to say thank you for completely opening my eyes to a whole new way of thinking. Without your podcast, I would have never been fascinated with the works of Graham Hancock, Andrew Collins, Robert Bouval, Joseph Farrell, and so on and so forth. He rings off a bunch of names. I'm still hoping I can find a way to go on one of your tours one day. Keep up the awesome work, Ryan. All right. Hey, Ryan, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. And if you guys, you know, I only have a few places left. This trip to Guatemala is pretty amazing. And what did I say? I think I said 1 month's rent is your ticket to come with us. So go to earthancients.com/tours. And you can read all about it. Hey, one thing that I want to mention is that I am trying to figure out a way to fund the show. And I've landed on Patreon. We can take real small monthly donations. And I'm thinking about having two levels, $3 a month or maybe $5 a month for specials. And I have a whole archive of interviews that may not be appropriate for public consumption, but if you're on that higher tier, maybe $5 a month, you get an access point where you can actually hear these interviews. I'll be discussing this in detail next week. But support is key to keep growing the show. It takes a lot of time. It takes a good amount of my energy each week, and tons of money is going out. Obviously, if I get an intern who's an assistant, I got to pay for that. I got to pay for a lot of different things. So I'm going to probably have Patreon on the program. That is a way to fund the show. I don't like a lot of the advertisers that are out there. I've had a couple contact me. I mean, you know, can you imagine selling diapers or something on the show? I don't want to do that. I want you guys to have it clean. I want a clean show. So look forward to me talking about it next week. And, you know, just a couple of bucks per month and, you know, you get Earth Ancients, but there's a possibility to get a lot of other things too. I'm going to be ramping up a really dynamite newsletter. There is a chance to ask questions live of some of our guests that will be on the higher level. There's a lot of things I'm going to offer to you, the audience, the listening audience. So stay tuned for that.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Each week, Earth Ancients features a number of galleries from different members and myself around the world who are located in areas that are of interest to us. We have the latest information from a number of archaeological websites, and we have first-run articles and information that you can see on the Facebook page. And we have a Facebook group page as well as international. Everything is automatically posted to earthancients.com. So if you're not into the social media, check out earthancients.com. Lots of material there. We had a submission from Indonesia. Someone had, one of our members had a drone with a really good camera, and they shot Gunung Panang, the pyramid in Indonesia that is now thought to be at least 20,000 years old, probably much, much further. The government stopped excavation of that site simply because they were getting some insane dates. Now, this is all done by Dr. Danny Hillman, who we've had on the show a number of times. And he has is currently looking for additional funding so he can complete his research. But the flyover is unique because not only are they looking at the top of this pyramid, but you can see the massive stones that were pushed around in some horrific event. Now, we don't know if it was a tsunami or earthquake or whatever, but the displacement of these massive multi-ton stones really puts into question what happened to this fascinating site. So you can check that out and the video on the Facebook page. We have an excellent gallery that was submitted to one of our European members. It's a stone masonry from around the world gallery. There's over 170 plus photos. This is a really good look. This is an excellent look, actually, at some of the advanced stonework that we just don't know how they were achieved. There's areas where we can see cuts with saws and other power equipment. We go from Giza Plateau in Egypt. We're in Peru, Mexico, China. It's really stone masonry from around the world. You can see that on the Facebook page. LIDAR technology is in the news, and this is a big article I have. Scientists from America, it's actually a unified group, were down in Mexico, close to Morales, and they have used LIDAR to find a massive unknown Aztec city that dates to over 1,000 years ago. Now, we recently heard from some scientists that were in Guatemala and uncovered 60,000 plus buildings, pyramids, and foundations. This is just as impressive. They discovered 40,000 foundation pyramidal structures and buildings in this once vast Aztec city that had a population of over 100,000 people. This LIDAR is really revolutionizing our way of looking at the ancient past. And this is a fantastic discovery. And they're just going to continue it. Now, I mean, when we were down in Yucatan back recently in November, I had heard from a couple of different archaeologists that they're going to be flying over a number of the open areas there. And I am quite convinced that they're going to see at least the many thousands that I've been told are there. I suspect there'll be 10,000 or more just in the northern Yucatan area that have been yet to be uncovered. So LIDAR is in the news, and this is a wonderful invention, a very advanced technology that is as important as C14 dating, carbon-14 dating. This LIDAR technology is just literally revolutionizing our way of seeing the past. I want to mention I posted a video of John Anthony West and Graham Hancock, who were in New York doing a lecture together, not a debate, but more of a presentation on ancient unknown civilization. It was recorded in December of 2016. John was got ill after that a few months later. He got quite ill. And this is an excellent video. It's the last major presentation he gave, and you can see it on the Facebook page. Michael Glickman, the foremost authority, one of the foremost authorities on crop circles, has submitted a new article on new crop circle formations in England that is dated to February 16th. So it's been the last couple of months. And some of these new formations are just amazing. People say they're fake. And he admits that there's a portion that are not, that are suspicious, but quite a few of them are simply amazing. Check them out, as with everything else, on the Facebook page. This is All Things Egypt Month, and you cannot talk about Egypt without going to YouTube and seeing the plethora of videos on pyramids, on discoveries, on aliens, on anything weird to do with Egypt. But we've had on our show Chuck from CF Apps 7865 a couple of times, and he, in my opinion, is one of the better producers and hosts of his own series of Egypt-related videos. And I wanted to have him on the show to give us his top three videos for this month, and we got him on now. Chuck, how you doing?
Thanks, Cliff. I'm doing good.
Great. So we want to go through your top three for our listeners so they can take a look at what you feel are very, very important discoveries. Let's go ahead and start with your first top video. What's unique about it?
Well, those who have been checking out my channel and other channels around YouTube, the big mystery these days is what the Egyptologists call the unfinished pyramids. And when you really research it, it's pretty obvious that they were never pyramids. They were obviously never tombs. There is one at Zayat al-Aryan that is truly a mystery. And the attribution of it just is flimsy, just like most of the pyramids in Egypt. But remarkably, it's exactly like the one, it's now pretty famous, the Pyramid of Djedefre on top of a hill in the northernmost spot of pyramids at Abu Ruwash. And Zahi Hawass claims that the Pyramid of Djedefre is this great discovery by Egyptologists. It was this great pyramid that went to a certain height on top of this hill, and it was all majestic. And then he calls the one at Zayat al-Aryan and the one at Saqqara and all these other unfinished pyramids unfinished. There's a total discrepancy. There's nothing Egyptian in these. There's strange tub-like sarcophagus that were found at Djedefre and Zayat al-Aryan, and it's just a true mystery, and I'm glad other people are working on it.
Cool. So what's the title of this video? And I'm going to go ahead and put it up on our Facebook page, but they can go to CFApps7865, which is your tagline, which is basically where they can find all these. But give us the title, and I will put it up on the Facebook page.
Well, the one that I'd like to direct people to, it's the Zayat al-Aryan and Djedefre Pyramid Comparison video, and that's one I sent you a link to.
Okay.
And that really shows how similar these two structures are. But Egyptologists have two totally different stories of these two structures, so they really contradict themselves. And man, you just don't have any real solid evidence, because it seems like everybody who visited this face in dynastic Egyptian history put their cartouche or a little story there.
Okay.
So you just have a wide range, just a huge range of people who they think built this pyramid. And it's obviously, to me, pre-dynastic. And it has no similarity to a tomb.
Okay. What's the approximate length of that video you posted? Do you know?
That one on the comparison, I think it's between 10 and 15 minutes. And I also did one in August that they can find on my front page called The Atlantean Pyramid Cover-Up Exposed. And that was really the first one that people have done on Zayat El-Aryan, and that kind of got the ball rolling. So those videos they can find on my front page of my site.
Okay, cool. Let's do the next one, which is the Serapeum video, which I'm fascinated by. But what do you highlight in that video?
Well, the Serapeum just doesn't make any sense. You have huge 100-150-ton sarcophagus that are laid out in underground chambers, and today, if we were moving a 150-pound sarcophagus, we would need a highly skilled big truck with counterbalances just to move it a little ways. So how they got these into these underground burial chambers, and they're perfectly smooth, polished granite. The dynastic Egyptians would have had no ability to make them. The Serapeum, I think, is definitely one of the top three mysteries in Egypt because it just smells of something that came before the dynastic Egyptians. And right. The dynastic Egyptians found the Serapeum, obviously, because on some of these perfectly polished and made huge sarcophagus, there is hieroglyphs, but they are so poorly made that it's obvious that somebody just tried to attach their story to these huge mammoth sarcophagus that don't make any sense.
Sounds
and,
weird.
I just like to say there's a channel called Pukajay Productions that made a video down in the Serapeum, and they brought Yusuf Aswan, I think that's his name, down there.
Mm-hmm.
And
we had Yusuf on the show a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so. He's highly, highly knowledgeable, but he goes over perfectly how these hieroglyphs were just made maybe in the Ptolemaic era, maybe about 2,000 years ago, and they don't fit with the chronology.
Cool. All right, Chuck. All right, this is great. If you're interested in this, check it out on Facebook. We'll have it attached to the website. But also, Chuck has a ton of amazing videos. You can go to CFAPP7865. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the interest, Cliff, and I'll talk to you anytime.
Sounds great. Important to check in with our media critic, Adam Young, to see this third week of the month, the 17th, what is happening with material that covers ancient Egypt. And there's a ton of material, but we want to focus down on the real informative videos, books, media pieces that are enlightening for us, that are well made. Adam, what do you got for us this week?
Hey, Cliff. First up this week, I wanted to mention the Pyramid Code. This is probably familiar to a lot of your listeners. It was made in 2009 by Dr. Carmen Boltier, who's in the graduate division of educational research in Calgary, the University of Calgary. I saw this when it first came out. I thought it was interesting, and then watched it again a year or two later, and it kind of hit me, and I said, oh my, I have to go to Egypt. I saw Hakim Alyan speak, and I felt like something was pulling me to meet the man. And unfortunately he had already passed away, but I was lucky enough to travel with his son, two of his sons, and a few other people. But anyway, the Pyramid Code is a great introduction to Egypt. It makes the case for a few things, for a very ancient civilization that predates dynastic Egypt. And along the same lines, it makes the case for highly advanced technology. She interviews geologists, physicists, and astrophysicists, archaeologists, both traditional and the New Age or the alternative mindset. as well as people from the fields of like biological engineering, physical engineering, magnetic field theory. And essentially what she says is that the hieroglyphs, the entire culture itself, is really based on science. It's not based on gods. It's not based on our current sort of notion or what we would read in a textbook. It's really based on the principles that govern our existence in the universe. She also has a lot of famous names. John Anthony West is in there. Robert Bouval, Robert Schock. As I mentioned, Hakim Aouyan, Walter Cruttenden, John Daring, and a few other people. So,
yeah,
you
she actually
seen this,
went over there. She was working with Hakim when he was alive, apparently. We had her on the show. And this is an excellent, excellent introduction to Egypt for those of you listening. And great, great reference, Adam, because I completely forgot about a pyramid code. It's really a great primer to what's happening there. Okay, let's move on to the next one, the Nubian spirit. Tell us about the Nubian spirit.
Okay, this is something you can find on YouTube. It's actually in fairly high def, and it's beautifully shot. It's called The Nubian Spirit, The African Legacy of the Nile Valley. It's from 2008 by a company called Black Nine Films. They're from the UK. And as I said, it's really nicely shot. There's lots of good imagery. And it focuses on Nubia, which, for those of you who don't know, it's right south of Egypt. It kind of would encompass modern day Sudan and that region. And essentially what it does is it traces the roots of that area back. And those people, the Nubians, combined or merged with the Kemet group of people, and they sort of inherited Egypt, or dynastic Egypt, if you will. And after Egypt sort of fell apart, Nubia retreated and lasted. So they predated dynastic Egypt and they postdated it. This documentary is about an hour long. It features a lot of African scholars as well as European scholars, which, as you know, is sort of a rarity. Right.
Yeah, it sounds good. How can people see it? Where is it located?
That's on YouTube.
Okay. Now, the Pyramid Code we failed to mention is only available on Netflix, right? You checked it out on Netflix. So I guess if you if you want to see the Pyramid Code, if you're not a member of Netflix, probably going to have to buy it on Amazon. Other than that, where can they get it?
I think you're right. You probably can buy it on Amazon Prime, or if you're not a Netflix member. Netflix picked it up, so they might actually own the exclusive rights to it.
Okay, cool. All right, Pyramid Code, Nubian Spirit, which is a good one because we're talking about African-centric Egypt today with our guest. What's the third title for people?
I wanted to also mention a woman named Patricia Aouyan. She's the wife of one of the sons of Hakim Aouyan, and she is a symbologist. She's American. She lives in Egypt, and she gave a lecture last year at the Megalomania Conference in the UK. It was in the spring of 2017. You can see this on YouTube. And it's about an hour long as well. She talks about a lot of the ancient symbols that are found in hieroglyphics, and she relates them to cultures around the world and talks about both the kind of ethereal and as well as the tangential, the tangent sort of side of Egypt. So for those of you who are a little more spiritual oriented or those of you who are more focused on the physics and the technology, she's a really great because she blends the two pretty seamlessly.
Excellent. Okay, and they can see that on YouTube. For those of you listening, I will post these references from our media guide, the media critic Adam Young, on our Facebook page, which will automatically load to earthancients.com. Adam, excellent as always, and we will check in with you next week.
All right, thanks, Cliff.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Vital Transport is the official travel agency of Earth Ancients. And our upcoming tour, Secrets of Guatemala, June 14th through the 25th of this year. An opportunity to join me in a series of amazing tours to some of the top Maya ancient ruins of the world, where we'll see Copan, Quiligua, and even Tikal, as well as a number of smaller cities. We'll go to the top museums and other venues that are all about Maya. Now, one of the reasons this is a real key place to go, we are going to be climbing pyramids. And if you go to the Facebook page, you can see a number of the locations, specifically Tikal and Copan, where we will climb and visit with a number of the buildings that are still activating energy. We'll go on to some of the generators. And we have special permits to actually climb pyramids and structures. One of the top reasons to join me is in Copan, they have these very large standing stela, these standing sculptures of various kings. But they're not just kings. They're also highlighting PowerPoints on the ground. These are great places to meditate, to kind of commune with what the Mayas were all about. The Mayas were energetic engineers, and they placed buildings, pyramids, and these standing stela on PowerPoints. And these are very, very important to be around to for healing, for meditation, for evolving, whatever you're into. For the full itinerary, go to earthancients.com/tours or dial toll-free 844-368-4825. That's 844-368-4825. Come join me. This is a small group. I'll have cliff notes. Would you believe cliff notes? These are detailed analysis that I'll hand out to everybody. And I'll even give you a copy of my upcoming book as a gift to join me. Come out, see the details of the ancient world with me, Secrets of Guatemala.
So in our continuing look at ancient Egypt, we want to touch on not only the stonework, the buildings that are left to us, and we've talked to a number of people who have expertise in that. We want to look also into their sacred religion, sacred science, and today we'll talk about sacred awakening. We are going to focus on what my guest today calls spiritual transcendence. And this is a fascinating book that we're going to talk about today. It's called Dark Light Consciousness, Melanin, Serpent Power, and the Luminous Matrix of Reality. My guest today is Dr. Edward Bynum, and he has been writing about a number of subjects, but this one caught my eye simply because he has discovered a facet of ancient, what I want to call transcendent spirituality. We'll get his definition for it in a second here, but this is something that we don't talk enough about in today's society. Now, there's a lot of techniques on meditation. There's a lot of Hindu programs. We've talked about TM and other programs like that. But this is an opportunity to really expand on our knowledge of unknown, I want to call it sacred science. Dr. Bynum is a clinical psychologist and director of behavioral medicine at University of Massachusetts Health Services in Amherst. He's a student of Swami Saraswati, and he's the author of a number of different books, including The African Unconscious. Just, Dr. Bynum, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Cliff. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Well, I'm excited about being on the program and a chance to just sort of talk out stuff, you know, that you've had on your program before, but I want to make a contribution in my way, as you've already talked about, particularly what the ancient Kemetic Egyptians did and discovered in terms of methodology and how they fused spiritual science with physical science, and we have not even accomplished that today. So they were pretty far out.
That's pretty amazing when we talk about their ability to really understand the inner workings of these different developments. I mean, the different parts of the humanity is the body, mind, and spirit. But before we move on, I have a question for you. I studied not personally, but I studied the works of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. You basically outlined that you worked with Swami Saraswati. I can't even pronounce his middle name. But can you talk a little bit about your work with him and what that?
Yes, he was an adept yoga master from India, the southern parts of India, where yoga actually originated, and then spread to other parts of India. And his teaching and work and methodology was very, very, very similar in many, many places to the work of the ancient Kemetic Egyptians used to do in terms of raising what's called the serpent power, or the energy usually located at the base of the spine in all human beings. In India, that serpentine energy is referred to as kundalini. I'm sure you've heard that term before.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in ancient Kemetic Egypt, it was referred to as the Uraeus serpent. You've all seen it. Everybody listening has seen it. When you look at the headdress of the ancient pharaohs, you would see a crown, and then coming out of the crown are two serpents right in front of the pineal gland. And what that was is symbolic of that awakened physical and spiritual energy that moved up along the spine and, when successful, entered the higher reaches of the cerebral cortex and emerged above it. And it was symbolized by an awakening serpent. And it's the same symbol. It is the same symbol in slightly shifted form that we use today in modern medicine. When you go into a physician's office and you see her, she will have a symbol in the office or on the desk or in the front door with a pole with two serpents entwined around it seven times. Those are those twin Uraeus serpents. And they twin around that pole, which is the central axis of the spine. And when successful, they reach the very top. And when they reach the very top, what do? They spread wings. They take flight. So that is a symbolic expression of that ancient science. And many of my colleagues and medical practitioners today have forgotten where it came from. But that's where it comes from.
That is interesting. You know, before we get into the book, I want to touch on a couple of topics that you discuss in different parts of the book. One of the points that I was interested in kind of drilling down about is you believe that the Great Sphinx was built before 10,000 BC, or roughly 12,000 years ago. What is the basis for that? How do you understand it? I mean, we have Dr. Robert Schock on our show next week. We've had John Anthony West. But you, from your perspective, how do you come up with that number?
Well, both Smotch and West have revealed that the Sphinx has water erosion marks at its base. And the Sahara, at the time that they say that the Sphinx was built, was all dry. Mm-hmm. It was not. The times when that area was flooded with water and the Nile was much closer was about 10 to 12,000 years ago. Plus, another one pointed out by West and others is that the Sphinx, with the body of a lion and the head of a man, is looking directly into the vernal equinox, into the constellation of Leo the Lion. Yes, it happened 2500 BC, but it also happened 10,500 BC. So those are two very physical and concrete and measurable and replicatable bits of data that strongly suggest that the Sphinx was carved then. Plus, the third is the record of the ancient Kemetic Egyptians themselves. They say it was built in the time of Zeptepi, splendid time of the first time. So the Egyptians, their own written records and admissions, what we find from geology and what we find from astronomy.
Exactly. Now, I want to take it one step further, though. You actually bring up, you call them the followers of Horus, and you mention Shem, Shen, Hor, who were those people, and where did they originate? You kind of say that was maybe the group that were responsible for building the Great Sphinx.
Yes, well, from all the evidence that we have, admittedly, is incomplete, but the evidence mm-hmm. points to an emergence out of Central Africa, out of the area of Central Africa, and then moving up to Ethiopia and Nubia, and eventually over up into Egypt.
Right.
And they were the followers of a mystical cult that were the first ones to master metallurgy, and they were the first ones to map the stars with precision. Mm. So so they were kind of like shadowy figures that are lost mostly in history, but that's what we can see mostly about where they seem to have come from.
Do you believe believe that they may have had their knowledge handed down from an earlier civilization like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, the Atlantis culture, or do you think that they developed over there hundreds or perhaps thousands of years?
I think it may have been passed on by an even earlier civilization, probably not Atlantis. Probably more Lemurian. Why do I say that?
Yeah.
Because some of their philosophy in reference to the adoration of the earth is much closer to the Lemurian philosophy of adoration to the earth than it is to the Atlantean. The Atlantean mm-hmm. is usually associated with the northern tribes of humankind, whereas the Lemurian is usually more associated with the southern tribes. And as you know, as guests in your shows have pointed out, there was a great conflagration for reasons we don't know, probably before the last ice age.
Mm-hmm.
And then it collapsed. And there was a great civilization that the ancient Kemetic Egyptians referred to as Zeptepi, again, the splendid time and the first time. West and others bring that civilization back to around 15,000 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And more conservative people, quote-unquote conservative, would say 10,500. And then the classical Egyptologists just say 2,500 B.C. So I'm inclined to go with around 10,500 B.C. simply because of the geological evidence, the astronomical alignments, and the records of the Egyptians themselves.
I love it. I love that you're talking like this because, you know, what you're saying is you're basically throwing a wrench at history into the historical notions that man developed much, much earlier than the historians wish to record it. And we here on Earth Ancients have constant issues with orthodox Egyptologists who are just basically stuck in a rut when it comes to dating not only the Great Sphinx, but the various dynastic, pre-dynastic, and earlier people. They start off with hunters and gatherers, and all of a sudden, here's beautiful Egypt.
Right. It does. It's like a different kind of a magical thinking. You know.
Yeah.
Humankind were hunters and gatherers for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years, and then within 2 centuries, we have the pyramids.
I think it leaves a lot of space for people to say, "Well, the aliens came down and spawned the civilization."
Well, maybe not, or possibly there was a civilization already here and they had alien contact. There are many scenarios that are possible.
Yeah.
What we do know is anthropologically and from the genetic data that we do have, humankind, Homo sapiens sapiens, us, thinking man, evolved mm-hmm. somewhere between 150 to 200,000 years ago in the savannas of Africa. That is pretty well established. Whether somebody from the stars monkeyed with that or not, we don't know. But we do know that we in our present form took off between 150,000 to 200,000 years ago. And that's plenty of time for civilizations to rise and fall, rise and fall, rise and fall, to go back into the dust. I mean, if something catastrophic happened to us, how long would it be before our cities returned to dust?
Exactly.
A couple of centuries. And then in a thousand years, other beings would wonder, was there anything ever here? You know? So there's plenty of time for civilizations to rise and fall. I think as a species and as a spiritual species, we have come here to do a certain kind of work, and once we've accomplished that work, if we do, then we move on. My work in the dark light consciousness was hopefully building upon what a lot of other people have created and contributed in terms of the growth of our civilization, that it goes way, 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 way back, way back. And that we've come to this point now where we're now evolving into higher and higher levels of our spiritual science, if we can remember where we came from. I'm a psychologist, as you mentioned, and so a lot of the work in dark light consciousness is about the levels of mind that are enfolded in our present consciousness and what happens when we unveil it. And the ancient Egyptians, to my bias, my way of thinking, my research, were the most adept on a large scale of this. They're the ones who codified and wrote about, underlying the word, wrote about the methods and the techniques. You know, you were mentioning the ancient the Egyptologists of today, and they're still talking about the pyramids being the tombs of the pharaohs at Giza. Nobody has ever found bones of the pharaohs in those pyramids. Mm-hmm. They just ignore the data. Nobody's ever found them. They were places of initiation into the solar mysteries. And the ancient Egyptians, what they would do is they would, after the cleansing baths and the consultations, they would bring the devotee, the initiate, into the chambers, into the king's or queen's chambers, and they would go through a death and resurrection ritual where they would put the person into the tomb, cover it, and the person would have a series of adventures in there and experiences, which we can duplicate today. They used repetitive phrases, deep hypnosis, and they stimulated what we call today in psychology and parapsychology a state of dissociation and out-of-body experience, which you can do. A person, a very good hypnotist, can do that today. But they went further. They induced an out-of-body experience and then a traveling experience, which is what's referred to in research as remote viewing. And they were able to travel psychically, which very gifted subjects today can do.
Yeah.
But they did it on a mass scale for thousands of years. It was a whole civilization, particularly among the upper classes, that's devoted to that. Someone recently has been doing archaeological work with satellites, and they've uncovered, you know, many more pyramids along the Nile that have sort of been worn away. But there are other pyramids, and in those pyramids, for thousands of years, people would do this. So there was a whole civilization that was around this. It was very evolved psychically, but it fell, just like our civilization could fall.
Right. Let's talk about this book, Dark Light Consciousness. Now, I mean, you're focusing on Egyptian sacred spirituality. Well, how did you develop an interest in this this study? What was the focal point that kind of made you jumpstart this book?
Well, actually, I began many years ago when I was studying ancient mystical traditions in Africa and India, and I became very involved with the ancient Dravidian traditions of yoga, particularly the awakening of the primordial energy at the base of the spine, the serpent energy, it's called. And as I studied this more and more, I started looking at some of the neurological and neuroscientific basis for this. And then what other civilizations were also doing this? And that led me naturally to Kemetic Egypt as I got more involved with history, because there were constant connections between East Africa, meaning Ethiopia, Nubia, Egypt, and India, right across the Indian Ocean. There was a whole links back and forth. That's the place, by the way, that the ancient reputed civilization of Lemuria was located, there, until it sank for reasons that we're not sure about. But that's where most of the ancient texts and the lore locates Lemurian civilization, is in that area. Well, in any event, there were trade routes back and forth, and they exchanged not only mercantile goods and so forth, but they exchanged scientific ideas, astronomical ideas, and also spiritual techniques and methods.
What's and the time ancient frame? Egyptian, what are we talking about time frame wise?
We're talking about somewhere between 1200 BC and 6000 BC. That was when that was at its height for a long, long period of time. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Good. So let's talk about this Egyptian science that highlights Urias. Now, what is, and this is the focus of this book, one of the main focuses is Urias, which is the same as Kundalini energy. Can you talk a little bit about the focus of Urias? Because it's obviously a Kemetic in its take, and you just described how the Indian or perhaps early Hindu science would work with the African science of the Kemetic focus.
They,
so
they
what is
fertilize.
Urias? Yeah.
The Urias is literally, the awakened serpentine energy moving along the spine all the way up into the brain. One of the things that I focused on in this dark light consciousness, and where it gets its name, dark light consciousness, is I focused on the neurological, the neuroscience, brain science behind this. And the whole surface of our brains, the human brain, are covered with what's called neuromelanin. That's a dark substance that absorbs light. And not only does it absorb light, but it transduces light to higher states of order. So the whole surface of our brain, what's called like gray matter, that's what that is. Mm-hmm. It's neural. It's a certain kind of neural tissue. Well, it also there are clusters of this in certain critical areas of the brain core itself, and it proceeds from the surface down into the brain core itself, and then it goes down into the central area of the spine, all the way down the brain stem, almost to the tip of the coccyx or the spine. Well, human beings of all and every civilization have found ways to awaken that, sometimes by rhythmic dancing, sometimes by deep breathing, sometimes by meditation, some variations of all of those, but it involves stimulating and waking that energy up. And when it wakes up, it moves up like a serpent. That's its form. Moves up through the spine. That's neural tissue that's being stimulated. That's neural brain tissue all the way down almost to the base of your spine being stimulated and moving up like a current to the top and then through the center of your brain core, brain stem, brain core to the surface. And when fully awakened, it is amplified. And that's why there's so much emphasis in science and in the mystical sciences on the pineal gland, because that pineal gland is sensitive to light. It is literally sensitive to light and is floating in brain fluid inside of the skull. And when it gets stimulated by vibrations, as it's stimulating in the cavities of the brain, it literally stands up. It has like an erection. It stands up in your brain. Yes.
I haven't heard that before. That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, that's why that Egyptian Urias crown is right there coming out of the pineal gland, which is situated between the two hemispheres of the brain, sunken down in between. Yeah, so what we're talking about has a very profound neurological basis in addition to its discussions and explorations in the mystical texts. It also has a neuroscientific and physiological basis for this. And while this is esoteric and talked about only in certain quarters today, I believe as this century unfolds that we're going to start talking about this more and more and more until it becomes commonplace. And that's where I think our species is going.
And what's the benefit of heightening the pineal gland using this Urias technique or the Kundalini energy awakening technique? What is the benefit to us?
It is literally the awakening of deeper levels and higher levels of human consciousness. You know, as you pointed out before in other shows and other guests have come on, human beings have been in ancient times created civilizations of one kind or another that would rise and fall and rise and fall all over the earth. And before we had any civilizations, we had, you know, tribes of pre-humans running around, Australopithecines, Homo sapiens after that, many different tribes and variations of these Homo sapiens. But each one added a little bit more to the evolutionary influence and power of human beings. And now we've gotten to the point where we are here today, Homo sapiens sapien, thinking man. And we ourselves are a transitional being to a higher being. And I believe that as we awaken the spiritual energy and it becomes stabilized, not simply stimulated, but stabilized in our consciousness, that we will move into a much more peaceful and luminous civilization that has been suggested to us by all the great saints and poets and seers of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move toward a different manifestation of what we are, which is we are luminous beings.
Describe the state of this heightened awareness. What is the perception? What is a person likely to see in their reality? Or perhaps you're suggesting that there is one reality and then they have access to other realities. But I'm just curious what's your perception of somebody in this heightened awareness?
Well, I'll give you an example. Like you and I may be going to we'll go to a restaurant and we'll have a nice dinner. Okay. And then we'll have a very stimulating conversation about some things. And we realize that, you know, there's a lot going on and our minds are very stimulated and they're kind of excited and kind of expanded. Then we'll go to a great concert of extraordinary music, powerful, extraordinary music. And the music so captivates us that we are moved to tears and we even forget that we are listening to music. It's so profound. There's no separation between us and the music itself. Okay? Well, that is where we move from normative consciousness to sort of like a higher mind. We're having a very interesting, expansive conversation, sort of like a higher mind. And then we move into a place where we are just totally blown out and we are just full of a sense of awe and beauty that's almost indescribable. That's the illuminated mind. You see how it's kind of illuminated? Well, and then beyond that, in different states of meditation and different disciplines, would come what's called intuitive mind. And in the state of intuitive mind, you sense a fusion between yourself and the other, such that you can feel a profound empathy, and you're like with the other one. And all the major religions of humankind point out that compassion, love, profound empathy are where the religions are taking us. Well, that's where you actually experience it. People who have, when you're profoundly in love with someone, not courting, profoundly in love with someone, be it a lover, a spouse, your children, whatever it is, you have deep, deep, deep empathy for them, and you would even give your life for them. You can feel what it's like to be inside of them, and that you value them as much as you value yourself. That is sort of like intuitive mind. When you begin to have that kind of relationship with the different objects in the world, be it artwork, trees, whatever, you feel that sense of union and great empathy and profound awe with things to the point that you have difficulty even expressing it. And then the stage beyond that, which I try to explore in Dark Light Consciousness, is what's called overmind. And that's where it's not even mental anymore. It's not even mental anymore. It's more of a... It's very difficult to describe. The only analogy arts are found in great art or poetry, but it's a place where great spiritual traditions are born when the prophet can take us to that level. And then, of course, beyond that is what is referred to as, you know, samadhi or satori. It has different names in different traditions, but it's essentially the superconscious state. The uraeus, when properly followed by, in any tradition, and there are many traditions, I just focused on the ones that are the most well-established empirically, the Hindu, Indian, Dravidian tradition, and the uraeus tradition in ancient Egypt, they will lead you there. And it is where people develop and devote their whole lives to. That's why people go into monasteries, and monks will stay in monasteries for years in meditation and contemplation, or in the mountains. That's what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're trying to do, is to achieve and break through to that level of consciousness.
Now,
I believe
you,
that as
were you
a
able
species,
to find,
that's where we're heading.
We're heading there, is what you're saying. But when you were actually researching this book, did you find documents or books written by people in these heightened states of awareness who actually were walking their talk, so to speak?
Yes. Yes, I have. And I've experienced some of them face-to-face. And they are rare individuals, but you experience them briefly, and it's enough to change your life. And it's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of them, when it's done correctly, opening a door for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. And many people have had this experience. So you're dreaming, and then sometimes you become aware that you're dreaming, and you sort of wake up in the dream. Okay? That's a certain kind of experience. That's what's called lucid dreaming. Well, every now and then, people have been known to sort of begin to either meditate or pray in that state. And when they do, when they're able to do that, a profound light, literally a luminosity, breaks through. In the ancient Tibetan yoga traditions, it's referred to as the clear light. In the traditions of the uraeus, it's referred to by other names. In the Christian traditions, it's referred to as the nuos. So all the different traditions know about this. And what is so wonderful about the ancient Egyptians is that they mapped it out. They mapped it out. They're seven stages. They mapped it out. And the ancient Hindus of Dravidian India, they mapped it out. If you read the Upanishads and you read the Vedas of ancient ancient India, they mapped it out. So it's a science. So I try to approach it in dark light consciousness as a science that's replicatable, that's observable, that you don't have to have some kind of faith, that you can carry out it by experiments and see for yourself. And when you see for yourself, when you experience it for yourself, then you know it. Then you know it. And your faith is no longer faith, it's experience.
I hope we can talk about a few techniques later on in the show. You can maybe highlight people on maybe some meditative techniques or maybe something even less involved because it's interesting. I've been a meditator for 30 years. I started out, just doing TM and then kind of evolved it with some other things. But what you're talking about is more of a focal focus type of practice where you're bringing in other elements to enhance, awareness and perception, right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, focus. It's more of the path of meditative absorption, of concentration. And there are other paths, but this is just the path that I intuitively found that works for me, and those have been the people that I've attracted to. I mean, there are traditions in around the world where they don't sit in a cave and quote-unquote meditate. What they do is they get around ceremonial fire, campfire, and they will dance all night. Well, that's not just simply dancing. What they're doing is they're stamping their feet, if you'll notice very closely. They're stamping their feet, and they're flexing their lower spine and their hip. Stamping their feet and flexing the lower spine or their hip, And you do that for hour after hour after hour. You go into a trance state, and you physically are stimulating that uraeus, that kundalini energy, and she rises up. Remember, it's brain tissue. She rises up from the base of the spine, and she goes all the way to the top, and she penetrates the top part of the experience of your cranium, your head. You have a state that is difficult to describe in words. So that is the traditions you're going to find more often in Africa and certain parts of India and indigenous Native American traditions and the Australian Aboriginal people. You find that particular approach. But it's not only located there. If you read about the ancient Dionysian cults of ancient Greece, that's what they did. They would dance and sing all night and get really intoxicated and stimulated. It would not be sustained because it would go back down, because that's what it will do after, you know. So that's why the ancient Egyptian and traditions and the ancient traditions of India are so phenomenal, because they teach you not only to awaken her, but to keep her up, to sustain her, so she's stabilized in the higher centers of the brain. And that's what's so phenomenal, because she doesn't go back down. And the state of illumination is there. And that's where it means to be in a state of awe.
You talk a lot about melanin. You have neuromelanin, which is on the interior of the body.
Of the brain, yes.
Of the brain. But on the exterior, is that playing a part in the sacred nature of the Kemetic people or Hindu people or us? Is there something we need to know about that is
It plays a role, but it's a relatively minor role. I mean, human beings from the, Homo sapiens sapiens and our origin, we've been dark-skinned peoples for most of our experience. And in fact, it's only been, you know, we've been around for 150 to 200,000 years in our present form in one form or another. And so-called, quote, racial diversification, unquote, only began about 25,000 years ago. Really? And up until that time, everybody looked like an African. You know, that makes some people uncomfortable, but it's true. In fact, there was a report that just came out, another DNA study, and this has been confirmed hundreds of times. The most recent DNA study of what's called Cheddar Man, and discovered as a full skeleton, discovered in 1903 in Britain. Well, it showed that up until about 10,000 years ago, dark brown-skinned people with curly hair and blue eyes dominated Britain.
Yeah, I saw that. I posted it on the Facebook page. It was fascinating.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, you know, so we have to get beyond this foolish psychosis of about surface skin color. The big deal is melanin in the brain. And why melanin? Again, melanin, neuromelanin, I should say, absorbs light, photon, quanta. It absorbs light, and it transduces that light to higher states of order. It literally absorbs the light of the cosmos and translates it and steps it up in our brain. And that's what evolution is. Of all the creatures on the earth, the ones with the highest level of neuromelanin in their spine and brain are the mammals. Among all the mammals, the ones with the highest ones are the primates. Of all the primates, the ones with the highest concentration are the great apes. Of all the great apes, the highest one is a chimpanzee, and the only one with even more of this absorbing capacity of the brain and spinal column is us, Homo sapiens sapiens. So that's a pretty tight correlation with evolution.
That's fascinating.
It's a very tight correlation with evolutionary unfoldment of our species. We are literally beings of light. You know, we have all kinds of memories from some people, experiences from others, but certainly our mythology is always talking about angels. Angels are beings of light, right? Well, that is a projection of where we're going. if evolution is ultimately successful, if evolution in us is ultimately successful, that's where it will take us.
Hmm. So the physical form becomes lighter, and then the whole body begins to shift and evolve.
You got it.
Is that what you're suggesting? Okay.
That's right. Hmm. Even Jesus, even for those listeners who are Christians, even Jesus the Christ said that when the eye is single, the body is full of light.
Fascinating.
When the eye is single, well, that's what that means. When the pineal gland is focused, when the eye is single, the whole body is full of light. So this is not only a scriptural thing, this is a neurological phenomenon. And we need to, I believe, awaken to that and get beyond our mundane and conflicts and sometimes very dangerous conflicts and recognize where we are. We're all part of the same creature. We're all part of the same being. And we are in the process, I believe, of evolution. And what I just tried to do in Dark Light's consciousness was to marshal our scientific knowledge about this and point this and see where this might be going. And so that's why I spent a lot of time on documentation. Some people think I spent too much time on the documentation thing, but I was addressing this to not only you and me, obviously, but I wanted this to get to the medicine people, to the physicians, the psychologists, mm-hmm. the psychiatrists, neurologists. That's who's also my audience.
So they could probably begin to see these changes in evolution as they come up, these different children or adults or whatever who are showing signs of this new level of humanity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and to welcome it, mm-hmm. it, and not be afraid of it, because this is where we're hopefully heading.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we're hoping.
Do you believe that the Egyptians, it's probably a priest class, had obtained this high level of evolution, and that as whatever happened catastrophically to the earth, we lost that and now we're coming back to it? Or did they,
yes,
were they
yes,
trying
sir.
To achieve
yes, I do.
It? Where do you think they were, evolutionary?
I think that they were small, select groups that attained this, and they looked around and they saw that the rest of us weren't there. We weren't ready.
Mm.
Plus, we were pretty savage group of folks. I mean, the early humans were very peaceful, as we hunter-gatherers, you know, we needed to cooperate with each other, you know, so
right.
we were very peaceful, you know, but as we developed into cities and civilizations, our canine teeth showed themselves, and we became very hostile, frustrated, and aggressive, and now we're still that creature, but the other one is trying to break through. And, you know, we have moves forward, then we have steps backward. What can I say, you know?
Right.
But I think I'm an optimist. I think we're going to make it. I think it's more and more obvious as the science breaks through on a day-to-day basis that we're all part of the same species, that there are no different species of human beings, and
yeah.
that surface differences are just that, surface differences, but the deep structure stuff, the deep core stuff, is where our humanity lies. And if we can get our act together, and recognize what we really, really are, then we will fall in line and we will move toward the next stage in our evolution. And Dark Light consciousness is just a small, you know, little scientific text written today in current scientific language that will be outdated in 30 or 40 years. But for right now, it kind of expresses it.
Interesting. Is there a practice of this Uraeus that we can hear about? What type of work is done? Is it a sitting quietly and focusing? Or what have you discovered is one of the techniques?
I addressed both the hyper-quieting technique, which is what you just described, of making the mind and the body very quiet so that the inner luminosity shows. I focused on that approach, but I also acknowledge that there are different other approaches that will do the same thing, and you have to use your intuition and what is available to you to access it. I find the meditative absorption technique is best for me. And what you do is you quiet the body. You find a different way. Sitting will do it, but just sitting quietly.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes sitting quietly and breathing diaphragmatically. I want to emphasize that. Diaphragmatically breathing for about 5 minutes or so, and then gradually continue that, but focus on the exhalation phase of the breathing cycle. When you do that, that will quiet down, slow down your heart rate. It'll slow down your brain waves. It will lower your blood pressure. This is why, you know, I use this in clinical practice also. And then if you can do that for another 5 minutes or so, then the old Indian technique, Hindu-Indian technique of alternate nostril breathing, where you breathe out of one nostril at a time using your fingers for another 3 or 4 minutes, and then focus at the top of the lip and the bottom of the nose. And that will just create a quieting response. And once you can quiet your mind down, then you get little intuitions here and there. There's actually something beyond my mind out there and in here. But you've got to quiet down the noise. And we're a hyperactive civilization. We're constantly distracting ourselves. There's almost a taboo of being quiet, you know?
Right.
We're suspicious of it. We're suspicious of it. But quieting down the mind by manipulating the environment a little bit, manipulating the body a little bit, manipulating the nervous system a little bit. And there are sections in Dark Light Consciousness that I spend a lot of time describing in detail that and discussing it and showing the scientific and neurological basis for that, so that I just don't say it. You take it on faith. No. This is it, and try it and experiment and see for yourself. Once you've done it, then, you know, you begin to quiet the mind enough to begin to do other things. Meditation, early stages of meditation, is just detergent. It's just supposed to clean the surface of your mind enough so that you can get down to other things. You know, but the technique is not, you know, where you're going. The technique is just the road.
Oh, so you're suggesting that the classic meditations where you use a mantra to quiet the mind down is just the beginning, and then you can start working on other
things?
The
beginning. Yes, okay. Just the beginning. The purpose of the mantra, is to capture your mind. If you can capture your mind,
right,
you can freeze it. And then once you freeze your mind, then the one who witnesses your mind can step back a little bit. You are not the same as your mind, right? I mean, you wouldn't confuse yourself with your foot, right? You have a foot or you have a hand. You wouldn't say, I am my hand. You have a hand. And the same can be said about your mind. You have a mind, but you're not the same as your mind. So quieting your mind down allows you to sort of like watch yourself watching your mind. And it's you can do it by going in one direction or the other. And the ancient Kemetic Egyptians, they, using the dissociation techniques, that's what we call it in psychology and psychiatry today, is dissociation. Dissociative techniques, rhythmic breathing, incantation, repetition to induce that dissociation and out-of-body state. Because the whole point of their methodology, the whole point of the initiation was to prove unequivocally to the initiate the separation of the self from the body, that one is one's not one's body. That's why the Egyptians were so, they discovered something. And they spent, you know, thousands and thousands of years doing this because they figured something out. They figured something out, you know. Our, unfortunately, whenever, you know, you've seen this, whenever we look, almost always when we look at ancient Egypt in the movies, we get some story about a mummy. The mummy's coming back from the dead, and he's going to get you, and he's going to do all these bad things to you and all this kind of stuff. This is all scare tactics and propaganda to turn people away, scare people away from the great secret, you know? So you put a wolf in front of the cave so you won't go in the cave.
Right. Would you say that there are any redeeming values to current life here in Western culture? I mean, I discovered the meditative practice when I was 18, just because I was curious about it. And at that time, drugs were a big deal, and I wasn't into that, so I got into meditation. But is there anything about present culture that would you say, a benefit that takes us to these higher realms? I personally don't see it, but maybe you see something from your perspective.
Well, I do in the sense that it's it's oftentimes bewildering, but it's like a spiritual supermarket. You can go down to a used bookstore on the street or a mall, and you can get for a few dollars classic texts of the ages. Think about that. You, for a few bucks, can go and buy the Wisdom of the Ages in the Bhagavad Gita, in the ancient Vedas of India. You can,
right.
You can buy for $5 a used copy of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I mean, this the kind of stuff that used to be unavailable to the overwhelming majority of people, you can buy for peanuts. Now, it's also the case that very often people don't do it. That's the other side of it. But the point is, it's here. And one of the other benefits of modern, quote-unquote, civilization, at least in the Western part of the world where we are, is you're free to experiment. You're free to experiment, try stuff out. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you can try, and you're free to do it. Whereas in many other cultures and civilizations, you can't do it. And and you'd be called a heretic or worse. And you could lose your life for it. So that's one of the great advantages of a liberal, progressive civilization. On the one hand, yeah, we can elect all kinds of idiots to the highest office of the land.
I wasn't going to go there. I was waiting.
Well, it's true. It's true. But we can also go and find the greatest books that have ever been written. And you're free to make contact with other kindred spirits and to discuss it and to exchange your experiences and ideas. So
that's something I haven't thought of before.
It's generally a plus.
You're saying when you're reading a classic piece of literature, you're connecting either with the author or the people that he talks about or she talks about in her work. Is that what you're suggesting? Kind of a transitional phase of consciousness or something?
Well, I don't know if it's a transitional phase, but it's you can go to the library now. That's not that the library is taboo, and you can read it. It's not that you're going to immediately understand it, but the fact that you can even read it is to me is just phenomenal. Because in the past, most people couldn't read, let alone study these methodologies where you can. And but it helps you kind of like sort this out. And that is one of the gifts and one of the weirdnesses of our age is that you can go and do this. And some people are freaked out about that. You know that. But on the other hand, look at the different diverse perspectives. And we are in the midst of rediscovering our ancient past now. And we're not letting it be dictated to us by Egyptologists who are many of them more preoccupied with getting tenure at a university than they are about opening new ground. For me, the ancient Papyrus of Ani or the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is actually the correct name of the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, is the book of coming forth by day. Think about that, coming forth in light.
Wow.
Think about that psychologically. You read it, it's a psychological text. And then all of a sudden it changes. It's not about mumbo jumbo. It's about methodology and technique, and about how to transform your own mind, your own consciousness in certain ways. And you can carry out the experiment and see for yourself, and begin to measure your progress.
Wow, Dark and Light Consciousness is the name of the book. What would you like to have the reader take away from this work of yours?
Them to take away that there is a profound, deep, and wide scientific medical basis for our spirituality of all forms, and that there is a reason why every spiritual tradition talks about the inner light. That inner light is literally quanta. It is literally photons. It is literally our nervous system absorbing light from the cosmos. It is literally absorbing light from the cosmos, and the cosmos itself is alive.
Wow. That's a fantastic thought. Hey, I want to let people know where they can get the book. So I am suggesting that they go to the Amazon page, and the last name is BYNUNM, as in Mary. It's Bynum. And Dr. Bynum has not only all his books there, but he also has a nice little biography. And I'm not sure if you have links to other articles, but all his books are on Amazon. So that's where we're focusing on today. And I've really appreciated the time. This is a fascinating book. I'm going to have to drill down a little more. I was reading some of the comments on Amazon, and I have to admit that for some of the readers, they're like, well, you got to read it a couple of times to really get the meat out of it. So you are channeling some heavy stuff, my friend.
Well, I'm trying to make whatever contribution I can make. That's why I'm here, and I know it. And, you know, I'm not here forever, neither is anybody else. So I'm trying to use the time and the skills that I have to the best of my ability to contribute to our collective awakening.
Fantastic. Dark Light Consciousness. Hey, I really appreciate you joining me today.
Well, I really enjoyed this too, Cliff.
Okay, that's it for today's show. I want to thank LeGrand Green, Mark Foster, Curtis Hartog, and the group that helped me pull this show together. Special thanks to Dr. Edward Bynum. My guests next week, our culminating presenter, is the foremost authority on the Sphinx, Dr. Robert Schock. This will be an intense discussion of unknown civilizations, according to him, a lot of new research that he has uncovered, as well as what he and John West were working on at the time of John's passing. If you enjoyed today's show, I would appreciate you going to iTunes and letting people know, giving us a couple of stars and a commentary. It always is very helpful. If you have suggestions for guests, send me an email. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com. Let me know what you have in mind, why you think this individual is a good fit for the program, and we'll definitely consider it. The show is constantly evolving, and we're looking for new information to broaden our horizon. Okay, have a great week, and we will see you next time.